From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission worries about a safety culture problem at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant.
Pilgrim has a lot of issues with aging equipment. The fixes that were done were sometimes just inadequate.
Also, Andrew Puzder is Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of Labor.
I gotta tell you, I think it would be the most fun you could have with your clothes on to be in this cabinet and get things going.
What impact could the pick have on labor in Massachusetts? And a conversation with Sarah Blakely, founder of Spanx Shapewear. She's America's youngest female billionaire, so what's the secret to her success?
When I was growing up, my dad used to encourage me to fail. And I would sit at the dinner table and he would ask my brother and me what we had failed at that week.
Huh.
And if we didn't have something to tell him, he would be disappointed.
That's on next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's start today with the latest installment of our series looking at President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet nominees and what they might mean for Massachusetts. This week, Trump nominated Andy Puzder for Labor Secretary. Puzder is CEO of CKE Restaurants, which operates the Carl's Jr. and Hardee's fast food chains. He is an outspoken critic of efforts to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, amongst other things. Here he is on Fox News last month.
I've been opposed to minimum wage increases that kill jobs, and a lot of these state increases are to that level where they would kill jobs. I think that's bad for American workers. But working in a cabinet, working in the federal government, there's really nothing you could do to stop states from raising the minimum wage. You could use the bully pulpit to encourage them to do what's best for American workers, what's best for wages, what's best for economic growth. But look, states have a right to raise the minimum wage, as do many municipalities.
Well, the current minimum wage in Massachusetts is $10 per hour. Unions and other labor groups have been advocating raising the state minimum to $15. Well, joining me now in the studio is Suzanne Bump. She's currently the Massachusetts State Auditor, and she did serve as Massachusetts Secretary of Labor and Workforce Development from 2007 to 2009 under Governor Deval Patrick. Suzanne Bump, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. So given what we just heard in that cut there from Andrew Puzder, how important is it for at the state level, whoever the person is at the Secretary of Labor in the federal level?
Well, it's enormously important because of the sweep of regulatory authority that the Labor Secretary has. When you think of the protections that we have for safety on the job, for wage enforcement, for pensions, family leave, employment discrimination, sexual harassment, it's a long list, pension regulation. So you can see that someone who has that sweep of authority can really have a big impact on even the day-to-day lives of Massachusetts residents.
Oh, interesting. So there's a lot vis-a-vis worker protection and other regulations. What about, where a lot of the focus is right now is on the minimum wage, because we just heard that cut where he said it doesn't really matter what the labor secretary wants because states have the right to raise the minimum wage to whatever they want. But yet he sees it as an opportunity to use the bully pulpit to convince states that maybe keeping a lower than $15 minimum wage is the best thing to do.
Well, you know that he's right that there's a lot of state authority, but we also know that a lot of states, dominated particularly by Republicans, are cutting off the ability of counties and local governments to enact their own minimum wages, which a number of jurisdictions have done because of failure to act at the state level. And there are lots of other ways that the minimum wage comes into play in labor policy making. So, for instance, one of the things that was done under the Obama administration was they extended the protection of minimum wage and the requirement for overtime to workers who are providing direct care services to people in their home, the elderly and the folks who are physically challenged. So there's a lot of impact that the Labor Secretariat can have. I mean, think of other decisions that came out of the Obama administration, rules around the payments or the need to pay interns who, in many instances, are being exploited in this by this labor market, misclassification of workers as independent contractors rather than employees, which deprives them of workers' compensation coverage or unemployment insurance coverage. There's a lot of decision-making, of policy-making that can go on in that office that is very much to the detriment of workers, and it's actually being called for by the business community, including, I don't know if you saw today, the Wall Street Journal endorsement on a to-do list of PUSDR, which is to roll back all of these efforts to try to address the economic insecurity of so many low-wage workers.
So let me ask you, one of the recurring themes here in this series that we've been having, speaking with folks who know about laws and regulations at the state level, is that many people we've talked to have said this is an opportunity for Massachusetts to continue to lead by either relying on it, on its state level laws that are already more protective or stringent than federal level laws, or enacting ones that would counter, in their view, potential changes from the federal government. Does that apply here? Are our state level laws already, you know, they protect labor from exactly the kind of issues that you were talking about?
In a number of these instances, we are fortunate to have the policies in place in Massachusetts that that regard the federal standards as a floor, not as a ceiling. The minimum wage that you mentioned at the outset is an example of that. In January, it goes to $11 per hour. We know that that's going to be revisited again. That was put in, increase was put in place back in 2014. We know that there are going to be efforts to continue the push to $15 an hour. But in other very fundamental ways, there is a lot that this administration can do that will negatively impact workers, is as part of this agenda to cut back regulation on business. So, you know, really, occupational safety standards are examples of that. Is one of the agenda items for the business community is to eliminate the obligation, newly imposed obligation on investment brokers to act as fiduciaries,
right,
in retirement planning. There are so many ways that these basic protections that were, to my point, in my point of view, my perspective, are there to protect workers, whether they are aspiring workers or they are incumbent workers or they are retired workers, really can be seriously eroded with this agenda of the Trump administration.
You know, it's interesting because obviously there are many people who are in support of Mr. PUSDR as a future labor secretary, but he's also been getting pushback from different corners. I mean, of course, our own Senator Elizabeth Warren was highly critical of the pick, calling it a, quote, slap in the face for every hardworking American family. But the National Review, the conservative National Review, also didn't like this pick. They have been vociferously in opposition of Donald Trump since he was a candidate for president, but they called it his pick making the case. They did not like the fact that PUSDR has made the case for more immigration, actually, in the past.
And I was just going to point that out. His position really is at odds with that of Donald Trump and many Trump supporters as well. I think that actually this cabinet position has the greatest potential to really disrupt, to make the Trump supporters unhappy more than anything else, because when you think about some of the core slogans, the core emphases of the Trump campaign, certainly an anti-immigration bent was one of them. But that whole idea of making America great again and bringing back the economy, it wasn't just that they wanted numerically more jobs, but remember those jobs in that golden area? They came with living wages to support a middle-class standard of living, pensions, health care. Those goals of those voters and the goals of the business community, they're not aligned.
Well, Suzanne Bump is Massachusetts State Auditor, and she also served as Secretary of Labor and Workforce Development under the administration of Governor Deval Patrick. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's a quote. It appears many staff across the site may not have the standards to know what good actually is. The plant seems overwhelmed just trying to run the station. Well, that quote is from an email written by Donald Jackson, chief of operations of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's Northeast region, and he's talking about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. NRC inspectors are currently at Pilgrim, and they are struggling to interpret all the troubles they're seeing, according to the email, which was first reported by the Cape Cod Times. And those troubles include broken equipment that never gets fixed, equipment such as boron panels in the cooling pool where Pilgrim stores its spent nuclear fuel rods. The pool is designed to hold 880 fuel assemblies. Entergy Corp., which owns and runs Pilgrim, is storing more than 2,800 assemblies in that pool. And as Cape Cod Times reporter Christine Legere told us, the boron panels could deteriorate in a year.
If they deteriorate and they're not doing their jobs, it takes as few as, I think, 4 spent fuel assemblies that are highly radioactive. And if they are touching, they can ignite. And that's why these panels prevent that from happening. They prevent fission from occurring. The pool can heat up when fission occurs. All of the water in it evaporates, and the water is necessary to keep that radioactive material contained. If it evaporates, the overheating would cause a fire.
Now, if I understand correctly, inspectors from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission are at Pilgrim right now, and they're expected to wrap up the latest round of inspections today. Is that true?
It is. They're just taking a break for the holiday. They'll be back for a final week in mid-January to complete this, what they're calling the Phase C inspection there. And it's being done because the plant is one of the poorest performers in the country.
Does the NRC believe the situation with the panels is an urgent one?
The NRC says that it's a known entity in the industry. They are requiring that the plant owners shift around the rods that are in there, keeping the hottest of the rods and the most radioactive away from these areas that have the boron disintegrating on them. In some cases, they can use sleeves or these blades to keep the spent fuel away from that area. And that's what they're doing, basically. Yeah, it's kind of we're watching it. That's what they are basically saying at this point.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the email that you and the Cape Cod Times reported on earlier this week. It was an in-house email sent to the NRC. Sent by whom?
It was sent by their team of 20 inspectors. It was the inspector, the leader of the inspection team, giving kind of a status update after a little more than a week on site of what he had observed. It's actually a number of pages long. He had a lot of observations.
Well, and it seems as if what they've observed is pretty disturbing. I mean, they've observed that the plant seems overwhelmed. Overwhelmed by what?
They say overwhelmed by simply keeping it up and running. Pilgrim has a lot of issues with aging equipment. And it was noted in there that the fixes that were done were sometimes just inadequate. And sometimes things weren't fixed at all. And they might put it in a report that they noticed that a valve wasn't functioning. And it might go a year before it ever even gets into their action plan to get it working.
Well, and part of the reason why it seems as if the NRC is saying that the staff at Pilgrim are overwhelmed, it questioned their basic areas of knowledge, right? There's a quote here that says, the engineering group appears unprepared to answer all of the questions being posed by the inspection team. And that fact, says the email writer, leads him to question their level of knowledge.
Yes, he used it, the term scientific acumen. I think that, that's pretty scary. He was saying the specialists aren't really that good at what they do. They don't seem to fully understand.
Okay. Another quotation from the email has to do with, quote, the corrective actions in the recovery plan seem to have been hastily developed and implemented. Now, the recovery plan, is that regarding what Entergy and Pilgrim would do in the event of a emergency at the plant?
No, what it is the NRC is requiring them to put together a plan to demonstrate how they're going to dig out of this, bottom level in their performance. So that action plan is, okay, here are the issues, and this is what we're going to do.
I see. And he goes on to say some of those corrective actions have been circumvented as they were deemed too hard to complete. We are observing current indications of a safety culture problem that a bunch of talking probably won't fix.
Right.
So that is quite a serious charge. What is the NRC saying to you now that this email has been made public?
The NRC says that the inspection is not complete, that this was just, some raw data and quick observations thrown together, that there's more to be done, and that we will know what the outcome is 45 days after they wrap up, because that's the time frame they have, so sometime late February.
And how is Entergy responding? I mean, these emails coming from some inspectors at the NRC are questioning Pilgrim staff's basic level of competence and the culture of safety there. So what does Entergy have to say?
They pretty much always have the same quote, which is, we hold to very high standards of excellence and we are working very hard to bring our plant back up to a level that's considered, not just satisfactory, but better than that.
Mm. Well, we have a statement here from Entergy that pretty much says something similar. Quote, we have worked hard to address the issues that led to station performance decline and look forward to demonstrating to the NRC that we have made significant progress in these areas through the inspection process. Again, that's a statement from Entergy, which owns and runs the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. But Christine, just for context here, Pilgrim has been shut down in the past, right?
Oh, yes. It's been shut down in recent years since Entergy's owned it, but it was shut down for nearly 3 years back in the 80s for all of these equipment problems, failures to follow through. They had emergency shutdowns right and left. And so, yeah, it's been a troubled plant.
Now, just a couple little basic reminders to folks. The design of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant is the same as the one at Fukushima, Japan, is it not?
Yes.
Okay. One would think that just that fact alone would make people make the NRC and Entergy itself pay even closer attention than they might have normally done so. And in addition, it was just last year that Entergy announced that they are going to shut down Pilgrim completely in May of 2019. So is there any possibility, or is it too early to speculate about whether Entergy might shut Pilgrim down even before that?
Well, they have historically said that they won't, but I think if you look at the facts, they're going to refuel this spring, which is almost $100 million to accomplish that. They are going to have to adhere to the letter that they'll get from the NRC ordering them to fix everything that they find that's wrong there, which could, again, cost many millions of dollars. So, I mean, you have to kind of look at the facts and say, maybe they will say, okay, we're going to shut down in February.
Well, Christine Legere is a reporter for the Cape Cod Times. We've got a link to her reporting about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. The links are at our website, radioboston.org. Christine, thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Boston-bred bluegrass band Della May has been racking up accolades since 2013, when they were named Best Emerging Artist by the International Bluegrass Music Association. Here's Della May performing the title track off an album produced that year. It's called This World Oft Can Be. The all-female band includes Celia Woodsmith on lead vocals, Kimber Ludeker on fiddle, Courtney Hartman on guitar and banjo, Shelby Means on upright bass, and Jenny Lynn Gardner on mandolin. They came to our studios to talk and sing back in 2013. Della May, welcome. That was
hey.
So fantastic.
Thank you.
All right, so beautiful song, beautiful music. It's amazing to me that this band and what you do emerged from, as I've read, what began as a joke. This thing that you call man grass. What's man grass, Kimber?
This band sort of stemmed from an idea of all females playing really hard-driving traditional bluegrass music, wearing full power suits and not ever smiling and stuff.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that. For people who are sort of outside the world of bluegrass, I mean, how much of it is, you know, very male, very testosterone-driven? Is it tough to be a female bluegrass musician?
I think the reason that it's been traditionally a male-dominated style of music is because of the difficulty in playing it. It really involves a lot of really tough, hard instrumental capability. There's mm-hmm. been a lot of female bluegrass singers and a lot of side women who have emerged throughout the years, but not a whole lot of all-female bands.
That's exactly one of the things that's so remarkable about you is I know that everyone introduces you as the female bluegrass band, which is, you know, one of your defining features, but it's the music, you know, more than just being all female, which is really, really wonderful. Kimber, how did you find the rest of the band? How did you all find each other and come together?
After I had the idea of the band, I just looked to friends and the musical community. I would say, hey, do you know a mandolin player who's a woman who can just shred solos? A couple different people were like, oh, Jenny Lynn Gardner, she lives in Tennessee. And so I called up Jenny, and she literally just moved to Boston to join the band.
A mandolin player who can shred. I love that. So let's hear a little bit more music from Della May.
Sure. Well, this song's called Turtle Dove.
This is Della May off their new album, This World Oft Can Be.
As I lay my head to rest at night, when my sadness tries to confess, as it hung above me as I dream, oh turtle dove, I am not what I seem. Ooh, oh turtle dove, I am not what I The soles of my feet are heavy on the ground, but when I close my eyes, I am heaven bound. Ooh, when I close my eyes, I am heaven bound.
Della May performing Turtle Dove off their new album, This World Oft Can Be. They are live in our studios. Terrific song. Thank you so much. So there's so much to talk to you about the music that you play, but also the sort of what you represent beyond just being the female bluegrass band. Because I understand that it wasn't that long ago you took an international trip to Pakistan and Central Asia?
Absolutely, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, actually, a year ago, I believe we may have just departed to Uzbekistan. We started off in Pakistan, in Islamabad, and from there, over the next 6 weeks, we went to six different countries: Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. I can't believe I can remember all of that, but all of those countries do exist.
And this was on a State Department trip.
Yes, it was a State Department trip, and it was kind of a program called American Music Abroad. Actually, quite a few Boston bands have done that that trip, and it totally changed our lives.
I heard an interview that you did while you were in Pakistan, and you had performed at an all-women's university or college, and you played Turtle Dove, didn't you? You just played
that
song. Yeah, and what was the reaction?
Well, it was funny because before, this was right off the plane, and they were like, okay, so, you know, if you want, we can do this show today, but the show had to be moved to right a couple hours after we got off the plane. So we were like, okay, we're going to do this. So we went to the university and we're having tea in the back room and we just hear these screams and rumblings and people pounding on doors and we're like, what is going on out there? And it turned out that the girls were so excited to see us that they were literally busting down the doors to the auditorium. So they were like, we're going to have to let these ladies in. So they let them in. We started playing that song. And it was honestly like we were the Beatles. I mean, there is just screaming throughout the song, but the ooze on that song, I think they particularly connected with because it was something they could latch right onto, that sort of melodic riff in there. And, you know, they do understand English, but for us, it was like that immediate connection.
Now, that's so that trip, not only were you doing sort of outreach to the types of audiences that you're talking about, but I understand that it sort of bled back a little bit into your music. You have a song that you do in Urdu?
Yes.
That's one of the main languages, or if not the main language spoken in Pakistan. So, bluegrass Urdu,
yes.
Hit me.
Yeah. Well, do you want to hear
yeah.
it? All right. Great. Shelby normally does a very good translation of this song because I always forget what it means, but it is called Lab Peyati. It's by the national poet of Pakistan, Allama Iqbal.
And we do the first verse of the song, which is translated to mean, "There's a prayer at the edge of my lips so that my life may be likened to a flame. I'd like to go out and light up the entire world and all of the cosmos and all of the people within it."
Lapeyati heidu aban ketamanna meri Zindagi shamma ke surat ho khudaya meri Duri duni duri duni
do believe that was a first for our show, a bluegrass band singing a song in Urdu. You heard it here on Radio Boston. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
So that leads me to the last question I have for you guys. I mean, your music is definitely has that bluegrass soul, but as you know, bluegrass as a genre has really been sort of adopted by mainstream musicians. It's kind of hit the big time outside of pure bluegrass from everything from what Taylor Swift had a banjo player on stage, or mm-hmm. or Mumford and Sons, those mm-hmm. guys. What do you make of that? Do you think that you'd rather sort of stick closer to home in terms of traditional bluegrass, or are you more open to stepping outside and mixing it up?
I think we're completely open.
We've all definitely like had bluegrass as our foundation or one of our foundations, but it's really cool to see bluegrass kind of getting a little bit of the limelight of mainstream music. Mm-hmm. We're excited about that for sure.
Yeah, and in general, the music is so mutable. You know, you can really do whatever you want with it, and that's what we found on that trip, is that people can understand it anywhere. So if we can take what we have, that foundation, expand upon it, there's no really stopping it. It right. can be really amazing to see what can happen.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to have all of you here today. Kimber Ludeker, Celia Woodsmith, Courtney Hartman, Shelby Means, and Jenny Lynn Gardner. They are Della May. Thank you so very much for coming
Thank
in.
Thank you very much.
Della May, play us out. This week at the Massachusetts Conference for Women, 11,000 people gathered for the keynote address given by Sarah Blakely. She's the founder and CEO of Spanx, the wildly successful shapewear company that revolutionized intimate apparel. Blakely is the sole owner of Spanx, and at 45, she is America's youngest female billionaire. Her story is now legendary. It begins back in the late 1990s when she was a 20-something door-to-door saleswoman who wanted something comfortable and form-fitting to wear under her white slacks. So she chopped off the feet from a pair of control-top pantyhose, and the Spanx idea was born. All Blakely had at the time was a mere $5,000 in savings, but she had incredible, inexhaustible creativity, drive, and a superhero's immunity to rejection. Her first big break came in 2000, when a buyer for retail giant Neiman Marcus agreed to meet with her in Dallas. When we spoke with Sarah Blakely, she told us Neiman's had only given her 10 minutes for that pivotal first meeting, and from the start, she knew it wasn't going well.
halfway through my pitch, I could tell I was completely losing her. I mean, she was just not, I could tell she was losing interest. She was so perfectly dressed, like her pen matched her dress that matched her shoes. And I had a Ziploc bag from my kitchen with my prototype of Spanx in it, Ziploc bag. I had my lucky red backpack with me, which was my presentation bag from college, which my friends begged me not to bring. They're like, you cannot go to the Neiman's headquarters
with the red backpack.
With the red backpack, but it was lucky, so I brought it anyway. And so I just said, you know what, excuse me, will you please come down the hall with me and come into the bathroom with me? And she just kind of shifted in her chair and went, okay. And I said, I'm just going to show you my product on me, like what it can do. And I went in the stall and I had them on under my cream pants and came out and showed her. And then I went back in the stall, took them off, came out in the cream pants without them. And she went, oh, wow, I get it. And this is brilliant.
And she decided to buy them right there, right?
She bought them right there. She said, Sarah, I'm going to try you in 7 doors and see how it goes. And I mean, I was out of my mind. It was the first place I'd cold called.
Yeah.
I didn't know anybody there. You know, I lived in Atlanta. I started with the Neiman's buyer locally down the street. And that's when they laughed and said, you need to call our buying office in Dallas. I was like, oh, okay. I didn't know you had a buying office.
But then I love it because your drive, I mean, it wasn't just that one moment, right? There's like a series of things even after that happened. Like I read that you wanted Neiman to see that Spanx could sell, right?
Yes.
So you kind of created your own little market at the beginning.
You have to. As soon as I got into Neiman's, I jumped into action to absolutely ensure success. I mean, no matter what I needed to do. So I did 2 things. One is I called every friend in those 7 cities or friends of friends that literally I hadn't talked to in forever and said, will you please go into Neiman's and buy Spanx and I'll write you a check. And so I was paying all of my friends and friends of friends to do this. And at the same time, then I went into Neiman's and stood in the department store from 8:30 until 7 every day around the country in those 7 stores. My biggest challenge was going to be, I mean, it was amazing that I got into Neiman Marcus, but my product was put in the sleepiest corner of the store where it was in the hosiery department. And this product was for women that you may never go into the hosiery department. So I recognized that. So I would set up a display table and stand in the entrance of Neiman's or by the shoe department and literally show people my product on me all day.
Without telling anyone at Neiman's, you would just do this?
Well, yes, because then everyone thinks someone else approved it. I mean, it's so important to just ask for forgiveness and not permission when you're starting out, you know. I just kept saying, I'm going to ask for forgiveness as long as I'm not harming anyone or breaking any serious laws. Like, I just need to do this because you always know the answer is going to be no.
I love every minute of this. I mean, I have to ask you, I'm talking to you now, years after your company is wildly successful, you're a billionaire. I think Forbes said that you're the youngest female billionaire in America. So obviously, you're successful and confident. Did you feel this kind of the confidence that you're projecting now? Did you feel that when you were in the earliest days of Spanx, when you were doing all these things and hoping to have to ask for forgiveness later?
It's such a great question. I mean, I think courage is a muscle, and you have to keep pushing yourself and putting yourself out there in order for it to get stronger and stronger. But I'm scared and nervous all the time. The nerves don't go away, and the feeling of stepping out of my comfort zone. But people talk about how Spanx started, but I had started doing work on myself long before I cut the feet out of my pantyhose. And I was around the age 16 when some really kind of big things happened to me all at once. And I started listening to Wayne Dyer, mm-hmm. How to Be a No Limit Person. Huh. And I started really taking to manifesting things into my life, the law of attraction, visualizing things, and really trying to free myself up from what other people think of me.
Yeah.
And as a woman, it really was important. I had to realize that not caring what other people think about me didn't have to mean I don't care about them.
Tell me more about
that. And that was a big pivot for me. Well, if you consume yourself with what other people think of you, you're going to hold yourself back in almost everything you do in life. And I just think we got one shot. It's not a dress rehearsal. Here we are. I don't want to hold myself back because I'm afraid someone might judge me or someone might look at me funny or I might embarrass myself.
This is so great to hear because obviously every entrepreneur takes risks, right? I mean, just by virtue of being an entrepreneur, you're taking risks. But I feel like the risks are even greater for women because oftentimes we've talked to a lot of them on our show where they say, you know, it's easy to hear that voice in your head saying no. It's easy to hear that voice in your head like anticipating the rejection. And that's why I love the foundation story of Spanx, because it seems like you did the opposite of that. Like, you might have heard that voice, but you just ignored it.
Well, that leads me to talk about two things. One is when I first thought of the idea for Spanx, I didn't tell any friends or family for 1 year. So I kept it completely private to myself and worked on it at night and on the weekends because I was still selling fax machines door to door when I thought of the idea. And I did that for one main reason is because out of love and concern, people will bring up things you should worry about, right. You know, and they're coming from the best place ever. But by telling people your idea or what it is, your dream or what you're wanting to do, you're just for validation, you're opening yourself up. And I didn't want to invite ego into the process so early on. So instead of having to defend my idea and explain it to a bunch of well-meaning people, I just quietly spent the time pursuing it. And I intuitively waited until the exact moment in my journey where I knew I wouldn't turn back no matter what I heard. And it was a year. And so a year into it, all my friends and family just knew Sarah's working on some crazy idea. She won't tell us what it is. But I was telling patent lawyers and I was, you know, telling manufacturers, anybody that could help me move it forward. I just wasn't telling people just to hear if they thought it was a good idea or not.
Yeah.
And ideas are the most vulnerable in their infancy. The minute you have them, and it's human nature in the minute we have them to turn to our coworker, our friend, our husband, our wife, and tell them what the idea is. And when I finally did share the idea, I heard, well, honey, if it's such a good idea, how come no one else has done it?
Uh-huh.
And then I heard, you know, well, honey, even if it is a good idea, you're going to spend your $5,000 set aside in savings and the big guys will just knock you off in 6 months and, you know, put you out of business. And I think if I had heard those things right when I cut the feet out of my pantyhose to wear my white pants to the party, I'd probably still be selling fax machines.
Oh, jeez.
Or something else, because I don't even think fax machines exist anymore. But, you know, another thing is I was cold calling selling fax machines door to door for 7 years. And I heard nothing but no all day, every day. So it was just laying the groundwork and giving me really good training. But I definitely had my days where I'd get in the car and cry. I'd just drive around the block, cry. I mean, people would escort me out of their building and security guards would ask me to leave for soliciting. And I would get business cards ripped up in my face like once a week. But I found that cold calling, I have so much respect for anyone who's ever done that.
So there's all sorts of challenges that an entrepreneur and a young company faces when they're getting off the ground. And then I suppose the challenges change as the company matures and grows. So like in the middle phase when, you know, you had you were in stores, your fan base, can I call them fan base? Your customer base was growing very rapidly. Sales were great. I mean, what were the challenges that you faced at that point in time?
Yeah, I fumbled my way through it. I've never taken a business class. I'd never worked in fashion or retail. I literally just had $5,000 set aside from selling fax machines and an idea and wanted to look better in my clothes and was super frustrated that the people that were making all of our undergarments were men and nothing against men, but they weren't spending all day in them. So there was no motivation to make them more comfortable, make them fit better, make them work better. And asking so many whys, I was able to unpack that this industry had been on autopilot and was just making things the way they'd been made for 50 years without a lot of change to them. And so that's what Spanx did. It really kind of woke up a sleepy, tired industry. And I'm really proud that, you know, not only that I invented Spanx and it's made such a difference in women and how they dress, but that I raised the bar on comfort.
Hearing you say it, and after obviously so many millions of people affirmed it by being your customers, it's not rocket science. Like, why did comfort like get pushed out of the equation so long ago? Right? It just like it took you to ask that question.
Yeah, I mean, the industry had been sizing all of their products on plastic forms.
And not, so they, not real women.
Right, not real women. So all of mine are sized on real women. I mean, I can remember very vividly when I leaned over and asked them all, ask her how she feels. I found out that they were taking an average waistband size between a small and a large and putting the same waistband on every product.
What?
In order to cut costs during production. So I said, time out. Like, a small gets a small waistband and a large woman gets a large waistband. That's ridiculous. And little thing, I mean, there was a tiny rubber cord in all of our waistbands and all hosiery products that didn't need to be there anymore. With the advancement of Lycra, yeah, the product could stay up, but no one had ever stopped to even say, you know. So I was like, take the rubber cord out. And they're like, well, it's going to slide down. Well, have you tried it? Let's try it. And then sure enough, it stayed up fine.
You are so successful, and have you always been so driven, right? Because I don't think that you would have gotten as far or has done as well as you did if you didn't have an internal drive from the start.
I feel like I have been driven for most of my life. And when I think about where that comes from, I think part of it is DNA. But I think part of it is, I can't explain it, but since I was little, I've had this gratitude for being a woman born in America at the right time and in the right place, and knowing that I had nothing to do with that, that that was just sort of luck, and wanting to do the most I could possibly do with this moment in time and this opportunity, and recognizing how many women came before me that didn't have the opportunity, and how many women still now around the world don't. That's been a big driving force for me.
Wow. So what's next for you? I mean,
oh, Megna, I have so many things. I'm so excited. I have like a spiral notebook full of ideas. I have like 52 pages of ideas.
For the company or just or things?
Just in general.
In general.
A lot of them are inside of the company and a lot of them are outside of the company.
Wow.
I know. And I have 4 children under the age of 7, so I don't have that much time, but I really am just I feel very excited about life, and I love trying to do things that haven't been done before.
So last question then, because
does that make me sound crazy? Maybe
no.
Just made me sound a little crazy. 50. Maybe, well, I shouldn't have shared 52 pages.
Even if it did, maybe you have to be a little crazy to get as far as you have.
But they might not all see the light of day. I need more time, but I am excited.
I read, I think it was in the New Yorker, that when the I'm jumping back and forth in time here, so forgive me, but that when the Spanx website was first launched, that your mom was she like had a luncheon party or something,
yes,
and she accidentally, because of the name, directed people at the luncheon party to a completely different kind of website. Is that true?
Totally true. My poor sweet mom, she sent all of her friends at the luncheon to the wrong website, Spanx. So if you want to go to Spanx.com, I highly recommend you spell it with an X or you're going to get a real treat. Like my mom and all her sweet friends. She called me up. She's like, Sarah, all my friends are commenting about your new business. I'm like, Mom, how did you spell it?
It's the one with the X, everybody.
Yes.
Don't forget.
But you know what? I just joined social media. I have not been on any social media. I joined Instagram 6 weeks ago, Megna. And listen, that was a fear of mine too, believe it or not.
So one thing which I always ask, can you tell me the story of a time where something didn't quite go right, an idea or a project failed, and you didn't anticipate that failure, and what was it and how did you deal with it?
Well, the first thing comes up, and that was a little bit earlier in my journey, which was I'm a terrible test taker, and I wanted to be a lawyer, and I failed the LSAT.
I feel your pain.
Are you a bad test taker?
Well, I failed the LSAT.
I mean,
I didn't go on to found a billion-dollar company,
it's
though.
It's so hard, the LSAT. I don't know. I debated all through high school, all through college. Like, my major was legal communications. That was my path. And I took the LSAT and basically failed it, took the course, took it again, and failed it again, basically. I mean, my score was so low, I had to, like, it was barely on the page. And so that was really a disruptive moment for me and my path, but life had other plans for me. And I often like to talk about how if you think you're failing at something, it's usually life's way of nudging you and just letting you know you're a little off course. And when I was growing up, my dad used to encourage me to fail. And I would sit at the dinner table and he would ask my brother and me what we had failed at that week.
Huh.
And if we didn't have something to tell him, he would be disappointed. And I can remember coming home and saying, Dad, I tried out for this and I was horrible. And he'd go, way to go, and high-five me. And what he was doing was reframing my definition of failure. So failure for me and my brother now is simply not trying versus the outcome.
That's fantastic.
So that was a big gift my dad gave me growing up.
Well, Sarah Blakely, founder and CEO of Spanx, thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you so much, Magna. I'm glad we both failed the LSAT.
We spoke with Sarah Blakely yesterday. She was in town for the Massachusetts Conference for Women. And by the way, in honor of Sarah Blakely's father, Radio Boston listeners, I'm curious, what have you failed at this week? Tweet us at Radio Boston. And with that thought, have a terrific weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.